This is a Rabble Podcast Network show. New voices in your head. It's Radio Free Radio.
People of the Land, a project of the HOPE program at the Ohaze Education Center on the Tiendanega Mohawk Territory. In a series of four programs, we explore how Mohawk people relate to the land, past, present, and future. This program, the second, Past Tense. Grant Barty teaches journalism at the First Nations Technical Institute.
My father would share stories of our people here, our history here, that were passed down through elders that he had spoke with. It was a really confusing time for me, not only just because I was, you know, starting to become a teenager, but also because when I went to high school, the history books weren't very informative when it came to Mohawk or Six Nations people. They basically said, well, they said that the Mohawks were bloodthirsty people that were warlike, and they would wage war at any cost against other people. And that's what the history books told me about my people. And I was sitting there, I remember being confused in grade 9 history class, because I was thinking, what is this man talking about? Because at home and in the Longhouse, I'm told that we have a constitution. The Haudenosaunee, the Mohawk people, Ganyunkehaga people have a constitution, and that constitution is based on the Ngunnawaga, which is the great law of peace. And it's peace at any cost. Only war at the very, very final stages, maybe war would ensue, but only after 3 warnings. But the reason why we were able to control such a large area as part of the Six Nations, Iroquois Confederacy, or Haudenosaunee Five Nations League, the reason why we were able to control such a vast territory of land was because of our peace alliances with the other nations. So sitting in history class, I was thinking, you know, we have a constitution, it's called the Great Law of Peace, the Ngunnawaga, and this guy's telling me that my ancestors were bloodthirsty, basically bloodthirsty savages. And it just didn't make any sense. So I didn't respond well. And, I'd fall asleep in history class because I would just, it wasn't until, I guess, years later that when I got a job with the Mohawks of the Bay of Quinte, and I stopped reading history books, because if you break history down in 2 words, it's his story, and it's always somebody's interpretations of account of events. So you have to take history books with a grain of salt. Any history book that you read, take it with a grain of salt.
Trish Ray and Lisa Maracle do historical research for the Mohawks of the Bay of Quinte. We asked them about the role oral history plays in their work.
Sometimes we find disputes that come through oral history first. Somebody will say something, the old people said that, this. I think Culbertson was one of the ones where you had the old people said, that's Mohawk territory. That part's Mohawk territory. And when you take a look at the documentary record says, oh, yes, indeed, it was. And not only that, the Crown was always lying about it. So in a sense, the oral tradition in the community was absolutely right, spot on.
It would be useful to us to know where certain things took place on the territory. Like if, for example, there was always a sugar bush in this area and the people for the last, if we're looking at grandparents now, or say my grandmother who's still alive, she's 80, if she can recall, 70 years back, or what her parents told her of what was there, then we're getting, 100, 120 years of memories, and it's going to be useful for us in knowing what happened where on the territory, more land use, I think, where people went hunting and fishing, and what type of things were gathered, what type of berries, what did they do with them?
I think it's the voice that we miss in going through documents. Every once in a while we get lucky and you actually get a letter written by Mohawks, not a letter written on behalf of the Mohawks by an Indian agent, but actually a direct letter. But for the most part, we don't have that direct connection with the historical Mohawks, the ancestors, and what they were thinking and what they were doing. It's a big gap in our resources in doing the history. And I think it's absolutely vital, because it's only by putting the two together that you come up with the real history of what's been going on. You can't do it with just one-sided. You can't do it with simply government records. You can't. It isn't fair. So for me, it's sort of like, this is what we have to do, this is what we need to do, and every year more elders die, and we lose that key to that history, whatever it was. Was it how people grew corn and what they did with the corn? Was it stories about medicine collection or witchcraft or incidents that happened? But unless you go and talk to the people, you're only getting part of the story.
Until his retirement several years ago, Ken Claus was principal of the Quinte Mohawk School. We asked him what kind of changes he'd seen over the years on the territory.
When I was your age, we had what we call an Indian agent that lived here, lived off on the res, or just off the res, and the Indian agent controlled life on the reserve. If you wanted to sell land to your neighbor, the Indian agent had to approve it. In some cases, he was also the one that made sure that the Mohawk language was not spoken in any of the schools. The Indian agent decided if you wanted to engage in any enterprise, like a commercial enterprise, whether you could or not what you were going to sell, but if you could do it. And generally speaking, the Indian agent said no. In some of the areas, the Indian agent, even where there was agriculture, supervised the transaction of selling the cattle from one farmer to another. What you would do, say if you had cattle, you wanted to buy them. You would come to the Indian agent and say, I want to sell cows. You would give me the money. He would give you the cows. I would give you the money. Do you see what might happen? Indian agents were notoriously corrupt, but they had power. And they were usually the seventh son of the seventh son, which means that they may come from a line of bureaucrats, but usually they weren't known for either their compassion or their intelligence. And so you give these little fellows a lot of authority. They were tended to be, in my experience, pretty impossible fellows. They weren't the kind of people that you'd like to associate, because they saw themselves as quite a bit better than the native people that they were here to supervise or control. So we moved from that point now where the federal government and the non-native community virtually controlled every aspect of native life, controlled, you could or you couldn't, to a position now, 50 years later, where they're having a great deal of difficulty controlling what happens in native communities.
Bill and Marilyn Brandt operate one of the few farms still active on the Tayandinega Mohawk territory.
Back when I was a teenager, most of the people farmed. There were some humongous barns around here. There was just a bit of the remnants of some of those large old barns. But like you say, we're kind of back in the stage, and I'm dating myself here now, when they changed from the horse age to the machine age sort of thing. Everybody farmed when they had horses and cattle, and that's how they farmed. And then they gradually went into tractors, and they went into machinery. Part of the reason that the farming died out is the native farmers couldn't compete because they couldn't get the finances needed. Like, even though they had a farm and animals or stuff, they couldn't mortgage them to get the finances that they needed to expand and to move into the new system because of the Indian Act. When I come decided to farm, there was actually no place you could borrow money back then because of the Indian Act. You couldn't mortgage anything you had because the lenders couldn't take it as security back then. My counterparts, when I graduated from Kempville, they were getting junior farmer loans at 4%. I bought my first tractor from Household Finance for 18%. So that was just the difference. And there was no way that you could get dollars. So it was very difficult.
We didn't inherit our parents' farms either. Bill's mother wanted hers for herself. It was small. And my father was making his livelihood on his. So when we got married, we had to find some place to live, and we looked all over this whole reserve at possible places. We thought, if we have a barn, we can still manage, or if we have a house, we could manage. Nobody wanted to sell. So finally, a great uncle of mine agreed to let us farm his farm if we would keep him. So here we were, newly
sharecrop.
Yeah, newly married people with a strange person in our house who was very old, with very fixed habits. And he took a third of the crop, which was all the profit. But we had a place to stay and a barn and some really old chickens that he left there. So that's really where we started. I think we were kind of like pioneers, because we were very determined that we were going to farm on the reserve. And there wasn't any place to farm, and there wasn't any money to do it. But over the years, we sort of made it work one way or the other, because we're both kind of stubborn that way.
Velma Hill Dracup, a former band counselor, has been active for several years in the fight to stop the expansion of the Richmond dump near Tyendinega. We asked her what changes she'd seen in local water quality.
I used to ride my bike from the beach road down to Deseronto on the hot days, and I'd come through the res, and it would be nothing to stop at anybody's house, and they would have a dipper by the pump. I don't know whether you guys would remember.
I remember those old hand pump things.
Yeah,
that.
In the
oh,
yard.
That?
Yeah.
Oh, that's
yeah, there's
okay.
One right outside my
hair. Yeah, right out front of the barn there.
Yeah.
And then I used to just, I used to just pull my bike up to their pump and have a little rest and help myself to the dipper. Didn't matter. You didn't know who drank out of it. You didn't care. You just assumed everything was clean and you drank the water. And those were good days. We carried water in the house, my grandmother's. Even when I grew up, we had to carry water. We carried our own drinking water. We had rain barrels that used to sit outside, and providing nothing fell in it. And that was good for bathing in and things like that. And actually, those were good days. And like I say about with the water, and my dad, he just says, I never thought I'd see the day where you had to pay for a bottle of water.
You've been listening to Past Tense, the second in a series of four programs, People of the Land. It's a project of the HOPE program at the Ohazi Education Center on the Tyendinega Mohawk Territory. These people worked on the project: Ashley Nicholas, B. Maracle, Chad Post, Cody Maracle, Courtney Brandt, Jeremy Brandt, Josh Maracle, Mindy Thomas, and Shirley Maracle. It was facilitated by Michael Riordan and funded by the Ontario Arts Council Artists in Education program. Our thanks to the people who shared their stories, to Degondi Renekwa for the music, and to all the people who helped. Next, People of the Land, Present Defense.